Welcome to The Art of Construction, the podcast dedicated to helping you grow your business. Together, we'll explore the world of construction with some of the best minds of the industry. Your host, Evan Tilley, a micro-influencer and sometimes disruptor, will take you on a journey that will lead your business to the next level.
What's up, Art of Construction Tribe? Devin Tilley here, and I'm so jazzed for someone who I have been following for many moons, Jared Levy, who is the founder of Connect Homes and has recently left there and is an offsite construction advisor. And going back, we had Connect Homes on the podcast, and I've just been a big fan of all the things they've been doing as early adopters, and we're going to hear his story. And as we've announced previously, we're super jazzed when it comes to offsite solutions. I get to have my guest co-host, Jason Blanker, who is one of the OGs of the Master Facilitator Program and truly not one of the MFers that you think of a lot of time in construction. A Master Facilitator helping us make this and just a true champion of all things Art of Construction. And the kindling of our relationship, we're both big EOS guys all the way back of March of 2019. And he and I are going to be doing several podcasts at an upcoming summit in Austin where we're working with Nathan Wood, who we just had on the podcast, talking all about turning shared pains into shared gains, April 17th through the 19th in Austin, Texas. Maybe this will come live before, during, and after, because all these conversations all get weaved together because construction is not a one-sentence deal. It's many things put together. Blanker, it's an honor to have you here, and I'm super excited for this conversation with you. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Devin. It's exciting to be back, and yeah, getting to peel back the onion and talk to Jared today. Super excited for this this podcast and kind of dive into the offsite world and see what we can learn and share. And if anybody wants to join us on the MF tribe, like to hit you up and have join the conversation for deeper dives. Certainly hit us up after the show and. We like to continue that conversation there and keep these ideas flowing and put them into action.
100%. And the main message we're going to go down today is credit where credit is due on Builder Magazine titled Why Prefab is Broken and Some Suggestions to Fix It. That really got my attention. And we're going to kind of unpack that today, building from show 263 titled Housing as a Product, where we had to have Greg Leung, who was their former CEO of Connect Homes. So we've learned the different ins and outs over the years talking with Connect Home. But Jared is taking a new approach to transforming the way housing is built and delivered. And he's spent some time doing this. And we're excited to hear his story. And we're going to ask several different questions from this article of how it's going to benefit us, as things like, can you discuss the origins of Connect Home and your initial goals for the company? And I believe he had said 20 years later, we're going to hear his story to say where we are today. And so my whole perspective of after 20 years of lessons learned in the pre-interview, we talked a lot about looking yourself in the mirror. And I was just mesmerized and really took a lot of, when you say look yourself in the mirror of like a founder, a starter, a builder of things, it's hard. Some days are long and the years are short, but putting all that stuff together, those are the things I'm really excited for Jared to talk through with us and put that on the table. What are some of your perspectives, Blanker?
Yeah, so a lot of great gold that we're going to be diving into. And one of those things is capital innovation is hard. Getting capital for offsite construction is a challenge. It's not like Silicon Valley is handing over a bunch of money. There's been some ups and downs in the industry. There's been some people out there that have tried really hard, push this industry forward. Some of those unfortunately have failed, but there's some lessons learned in there as well. And so
you mean Blanker, when you and your family started your modular factory, it didn't just happen overnight.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, this doesn't. You don't just open up the doors and expect sales, and you get peaks and valleys, and that's a challenge in any manufacturing environment, and trying to blend on-site and off-site together. And so I think Jared's got some really good perspective that he's going to share with us today.
Yeah, and we'll make sure to put links for him in the show notes, but his content he's put on LinkedIn of like showing the proof in the pudding of like when they got going of like, okay, this is a challenge we had to overcome, and now we're unpacking that, right? So without further ado, let's pop the top, get to know Jason, have as much fun as possible. Lock and load, tribe. Jared, welcome to the show. Let's get started with the speed round, huh?
Let's do it.
All right. Tell us about your favorite beverage.
That's an easy one. Coffee in the morning, wine in the evening. And the only trouble with that is sometimes I worry I'm going to flip the script and do the wine in the morning and coffee in the evening, and that would be a concern.
What's a favorite place you've traveled?
Last summer, we went to Norway, and it was amazing. First time there, just amazing.
Awesome. Give us one story from that.
We stayed at this Geringer, I'm probably mispronouncing it, but Geringer Fjord. You know, it's one of the world's or UNESCO World Heritage Sites. It's amazing. And, you know, there's a few kind of really nice hotels there, but we planned our trip too late, so they were all booked up. And then, you know, I was looking at it on Google Earth, and I saw that there's this campsite kind of right in the middle of the fjord. We're not campers, but I noticed that there's like these little cabins behind the campsite. So we were able to kind of build our whole trip around renting one of these cabins that sat right on the water's edge on the fjord, where like all this like cold water was coming down from the glaciers above. And we went down on the dock, my wife and my son, and we were just hanging out there. And this old German couple came down, just took off their clothes, had their bathing suits on, and dove in. And we were like, oh, that's crazy. Like, I didn't know they were going to dive into glacier water. All right. And they just made it look so easy swimming around. And so we're like, we can do that. So we kind of get our suits on, standing on the dock, and we jump in, and, you know, I'm out in like 2 seconds. I'm scrambling.
And how long were they in there?
They're in there for like a couple minutes, just doing backstroke and smiling. And I was in there for 2 seconds, felt like I was going to black out, and came right out. But I have to say, like, all of us, my son and my wife, like, when we got out of that water, we just felt so kind of calm and refreshed. And I finally kind of understood that whole like polar bear thing of like that shock that comes with the cold water and how you almost kind of reset your body afterwards. It was amazing.
I love that. Like, that definitely wasn't planned. And that's what I love to hear, the different stories when people travel. What do you like to do, or what is your favorite hobby or interest outside of the construction silos we're going to talk about breaking down that we passionately call the art of construction?
Yeah. So I recently have become somewhat addicted to Formula One racing, mainly because of that Netflix Drive to Survive. But yeah, like I just, you know, I never used to kind of watch it or pay attention to it. And now I can't get enough of it.
No, that's really awesome, Jared. And we're excited to have you here today. And we're going to jump into, why don't you tell us a story that led you to offsite construction advisor and co-founder at Connect Homes?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, my story of kind of getting into offsite construction started way back when I was, you know, I was trained as an architect, focused mainly on single family homes, modern homes. And I remember, you know, I had one stint at a company out in Los Angeles called Marmol Red Zehner and Associates. They do really kind of high end design builds. And I was looking, you know, I had a project I was working on, and I was looking at kind of a previous project that they had done. There was this one window detail that I thought, oh, this is like really nice with the metal trim. I want to do this on my project. So, you know, I looked in the construction drawings for that project, and the detail wasn't at all what they built, right? Like, it's completely different. So I was like, all right.
That never happens.
No, never. So I went to the project manager and I was like, hey, like, I really want to repeat this detail you guys did. It looks really cool. Like, how did you do it? Like, it's not in the drawings. He's like, oh, it's not in the drawings? I'm like, no, you did it differently. And he's like, I have no idea how we did it then. Maybe talk to the site super. So I go to the site super. And again, like, we're a design build company, so we're all in-house. So I go to the site super. I show him the project. He's like, oh, yeah, I remember that detail. It was really nice. I'm like, yeah, like, how did you do it? Do you have a sketch or anything you can show me? He's like, yeah, you know, I don't really know how they did it. We had a metal fabricator who just came up with that solution on the fly. And then, you know, he has the drawings, I guess. I don't know if anyone has any drawings. So, you know, just one detail that I wanted to repeat, I couldn't, because no one knew how it was done. And I just realized, you know, everything is just this bespoke, custom home build. Everything's unique. Everything's a one-off. And you just reinvent the wheel all over again. And I just found that really, really frustrating.
So how did you get started in system build? You started out in architecture. What led you into offsite and systems built construction then?
Yeah. So the interesting enough, the same company that I got frustrated at because I couldn't find the window detail. Years later, they were starting a prefab side to the business. About 2004 or 2005, it was that kind of first wave of modern prefab when Dwell Magazine came out. And they brought me back to help launch it. So we launched that company, Marmol Red Zener Prefab, probably like 2004. We got tons of press. We were the first prefab home ever featured in GQ Magazine, first prefab home ever featured in Architectural Digest. We're on the cover of Dwell Magazine like multiple times. And kind of with all this press, you know, everybody was seeing these homes, these modern, sustainable, smart homes. And everybody wanted them. Like, we were getting thousands of inquiries, like, you know, every year of people saying, I want one of these homes. And what I found is that we were still kind of too expensive to reach that broader market. We had fallen into that same niche market of custom home building, which is high net worth individuals. They want everything custom. They want everything high end. They want kitchens from Italy. And even if you do it in a factory, and it's a bespoke process in a factory, you're not getting those economies of scale you need to really be able to unlock that lower price point and reach that broader market.
So from there, then you had left there and you had decided to start Connect Homes. Is that right?
Yeah. So the other co-founder of Connect Homes is Gordon Stott, and he was working for me at the time at Marmol Red Zener Prefab. And we saw this demand of kind of what we were doing. And we knew that if we could come up with a system that could reach that lower price point, we could really unlock it. So we left there. We started Connect Homes. I think we took like 1 to 2 years to really try and work out the system. You know, even though we had learned a lot from Marmol Red Zener Prefab, we learned a lot about what we didn't want to do and what we knew wasn't going to work. So we wanted to take that all that information and lessons learned. And we built a prototype. We launched in probably 2013 or 14. And we really launched with three key things, key lessons learned from our days at Marmol Red Zener Prefab. You know, the first principle that we knew we needed to follow is we needed to turn the home into a product. I know Greg Leung, our, you know, former CEO, also spoke about that. But turning the home into a product really was going to lock our ability to develop an assembly line process to build them at scale. And so once we had productized the home, we developed an assembly line process to build them. We got our build time to, you know, on average, a 2,000 square foot house every 6 days. And once we could build at scale, then we also knew we needed to solve the logistics of moving modules and delivering modules, which is a stumbling block in the industry, right? Because for these really big things, and they cost a lot to move them around. And so we developed a patented system to move them cost effectively. And so with those three things, we were able to really kind of launch Connect Homes and reach that broader market.
So you were trudging along, building Connect Homes, and things seem to be going well. And recently you've made the decision to leave Connect Homes, correct?
Correct. Yes.
So what are you doing now? I guess what led to the decision to why you decided to leave one of the companies you founded?
It's always a hard decision. You know, I think as a founder, there's a lot of, you know, blood, sweat, and tears that goes into creating and starting a company. And, you know, a lot of people don't even know, like, a lot of the sacrifices you do as a founder. But you do it. And so, you know, there's a lot that I kind of invested of myself into the company. So kind of leaving is always hard. But at the same time, you know, I always would hear this term, you know, founder's fatigue bantered about. And I always thought, you know, when I would hear it, hey, you know, like, starting up a company is really fatiguing. Of course, you know, why would you expect anything else? And then, you know, kind of when it sets in, it really sets in and you understand what it is. And I think for me, it was, you know, as a founder and as a CEO for many of those years, you know, my role was essentially to move any obstacle that was in our way. Like, every day there's a new obstacle that we either have to push out of our way, we have to go around, we have to climb on top of it. but we need to get a path forward and we need to kind of move it. And so, you know, that takes like a lot of your bandwidth emotionally, physically. And, you know, I always was willing to roll up my sleeves and kind of go for it and do whatever I needed to do. And then one day I wasn't. And I think when that hit me, I was like, well, now I'm really not of the same use to the company that I was when I was willing to kind of do whatever it took to get around this obstacle. And I realized if I didn't have that in me, then it was time to step away.
Yeah. And I think that's really big of you. I mean, it's hard. I mean, I own my own business and kind of went through the, you know, building it up from nothing. And yeah, there's sometimes some early lonely mornings and late lonely nights. And yeah, so I certainly appreciate that, you know, it's tough to do and, you know, building and growing a company and then getting it up and running and all that. So hats off to you for all that. So what are you doing now then? You taking a little time off or? What does the next chapter look like for Jared?
Yeah, I still feel, you know, I have a lot of unfinished business and kind of offsite construction and housing innovation. And so I'm not ready to quit. You know, 20 years of trying to solve prefab, didn't really solve it yet, but I feel like some of us are getting pretty close to kind of cracking the code, if you will. So I really feel like I have a lot of unfinished business. And so I'm starting to do consulting and advisory work for either other prefab companies or developers looking to develop a prefab strategy of their own and how they want to, you know, have a strategy for offsite construction and if that can actually impact their projects. So I've been doing a lot of work like that. And it's been, you know, really interesting, like right out of the gate, just seeing all these different companies with different strategies of tackling offsite construction has been actually kind of fun.
All right. Well, I really appreciate all the tee up and where we're coming from. And what I really wanted the Art of Construction tribe to hear is that, you know, some days can be long in the art of construction, but the years are short, right? Like 20 years. And he's saying like, I have the eye of the tiger and I lifelong learner. I still want to go this direction, but kind of like a paradigm shift. And I appreciate you sharing that story and kind of the premise of what we do a lot of times on our new Master Facilitators program is, you know, a lot of stuff is out there on LinkedIn. And I reached out to Jared from LinkedIn. And why I did that was a post that he made referencing the good folks at Zonda, where they did a Q&A and got his thoughts on this. And I hope I say his name right, that he reposted it from Steve Laderante. Am I saying that right, Jared? Yeah. Does that sound right? So who's the VP at Zonda, and he said on the post, a lot of companies have come and gone in our space. The success rate is pretty low. Sometimes I fear they have been too many companies with solutions looking for a problem. And that really resonated for me because every podcast, as Jared and Jason and I were doing all of the pre-interviews, it was, what is the problem you're out to solve? And the reality is there's so many problems, right? So it's like the riches and the niches to pare down on that. And then some of the questions. So what I want to do is kind of rapid fire through this. It was Builder Magazine and give credit to by Vincent Salandro, who did this article where Jason and I are going to go back and forth. And Jared, if you could kind of just re-answer these questions from that, because I thought they asked really good questions to help just for this discussion. So Jason, you want to start it off and I'll go next?
Yeah, I can kick it off here. So Jared, you kind of talked a little bit about Connect Homes, but can you really, you know, what was the origin? What was the, and what were your initial goals? I mean, I'm sure you guys set out to solve some kind of problem, right? Like, or what was the goal that you guys had in mind beside building houses and making money?
Yeah, you're lucky when they do. So, you know, I think it was, there's an unmet demand right now of people who can't afford to build a new house, right? So there's a narrow market of people who can already afford to do it and who can hire an architect and are willing to go through this painful process. But there's a really broad market that just can't afford to do it. And what happens is a lot of times they live in the neighborhood they want to stay in And then they go to a GC or a builder to do a second story addition or add on, because usually they've had enough, they've grown their family, they've had another kid, they need more space, but they don't want to move. And so they get a quote to do a second story. And again, like, it's way outside their budget. So their only option then is to move. And so we saw this huge market of people who just can't afford to build a new house, but need more space and want to stay in the neighborhood they live in. And so that's really what drove us to kind of rethink the prefab process and to be able to develop a housing product that could meet that need.
And Jared, you had hit on at the beginning here, kind of talking about the builder's fatigue and the owner's fatigue of, like, just that you knew it's time to step away from Connect Homes. But were there any other factors that contributed to your decision to step away from Connect Homes?
No, I mean, I think those were the main factors for me to leave. You know, again, like, I feel like when you get to that point as a founder and you're not willing to kind of roll up your sleeves and really tackle everything that's in your way to create that clear path, it's really kind of time to step aside and move on and let others kind of take that role and, you know, rise to the challenge.
And Jared, you've been around this industry for 20 plus years. It was interesting that, Steve made the comment, a lot of companies have come and gone in our space, but there's a lot of companies that go under the radar yet and have been around since the 50s and 60s. And they're just not getting the press of some of these new startups. Right. In your experience from what you've seen in the prefab and modular space, what have you seen that's really changed in the last, 20 plus years that you've been involved in it?
Unfortunately, not as much as I would have liked to see changed. So it's, I think it's been slow moving in terms of innovation. And, as I mentioned before, there's been a lot of failures and the success rate is really low. And I really we all want to see that change, because we all, I think, believe that offsite construction is the real path forward. I think that's been troubling. I think, the high profile failures have been a disservice to a lot of the companies that are getting into the space. Back in the day when we first started, if you kind of look at what we're doing, it takes a lot of capital to start factories and build big things. And so we would go to Silicon Valley, try to raise money. And, initially people, the Silicon Valley VCs were like, "You want to do what? You want us to give you money to build homes?" Like, it made no sense to them, right? And this was like, maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And they always wanted one of our homes, but they had no interest in kind of funding the company. And so, that was what we were met with. And then, a few years later, when we'd be raising a new round and we go down there, it would be, "Oh, we're actually pretty familiar with your space. We're starting to look into it." And I think they were starting to see that the construction industry was really kind of not only a huge industry, but one of the last remaining industries that really hadn't been industrialized, that innovation and technology really hadn't made an impact in it yet. So their eyes were opening up to, like, this is something that I think we could sink our teeth into. And then, a few years later, it would be, "We understand the problem. We understand the industry. Just tell us what you're doing differently. We want to be in the space." And so, I could see kind of the trends changing and the, headwinds becoming tailwinds. And that was great. But then I think what also happens is, when we have these high profile failures, it becomes hard again to kind of raise money in the space. And, that's what's going to be really needed to kind of grow companies and be able to scale companies with what we do.
Yeah. And it's an interesting dichotomy, right? Like, it's hugely capital intensive to start an offsite factory. But yet, and Devin and I were talking about this earlier today, yet you can be Chuck in the truck and Dan in the van with little to no barrier to entry, right? Like, I'm a carpenter and I can go be a framer tomorrow with no equity, no cash, and I can start, a four-man company and be a builder, right? Like, so you've got these two polar opposites, and there's not a whole lot in the middle. That's kind of where everybody gets squeezed out. What other hurdles, I guess, do you see in the offsite space, or what were you looking for, in the last 20 years that you thought would come sooner or that we would have that we don't have?
You know, I think for us, we never got to the point, and this kind of dovetails with what your previous comment, you know, we didn't really have a lot of automation, if any at all, in our production. And we were still able to, you know, build a house every 6 days. And I think that goes to your, you know, just, I can fill up your truck with tools, go out and build a house. And that's, it can be easy as that. And I remember kind of when we were fundraising, doing one of our rounds, and I wanted to make automation part of the storyline. I went to our kind of new VP of production who had come from aerospace and automotive, knew nothing about home building. And I was like, hey, like, I really want to kind of make a pitch on automation and bringing in a lot of equipment into the factory. And, you know, tell me kind of what your thoughts are and what I should be pitching. And he said, I have no idea what we should automate. I have none. And he's like, let me ask you a question. How long does it take you to build a floor? And I was like, I don't know. He's like, how long does it take you to build a wall? I don't know. He's like, until you know, and we know how long it takes to do every aspect of this build manually, and until we've actually optimized every aspect of this build manually, there's no sense to automate, because I can't tell you if we're going to get a return on investment or not. And so it was really kind of the first kind of lesson in, wow, like, you really need to be careful about having these kind of mega factories and with all this automation, because you really have to, in a way, like, we're in this uncomfortable middle between construction and manufacturing, and we're at this intersection, and that's really tricky to navigate, right? If you go too far to manufacturing, you realize you're still actually doing construction projects. If you err more towards just guys with tool bags, you're not going to get the efficiencies you need. So, you know, that uncomfortable middle was kind of eye-opening for me.
Yeah, I always talk about the gooey middle, right? And that's where we have really launched the Master Facilitators program, for this whole very reason of, like, it takes the Jareds and the Jason who have put in the 10,000 hours, but still want to move this thing forward and figure out how to scale this thing up. Because to innovate, you can't do it yourself, right? And so that's where Blanker and I are going to all these different conferences to tie it all back together through the Master Facilitators program. And I think you kind of hit on a lot of it there, Jared and Jason, but, like, I would love, we've coined it as system built, just because, you know, modular, manufactured, on-site, all these different words, it's really boiling down to systems. But what I'm hearing from you guys is a lot of the systems is just go ask the PM on the job site that has to just go figure it out. And it's this one and done over and over again. But Jared, what's your take of what are the biggest misconceptions about prefab?
Well, I think on the home building side, you know, one is kind of quality. And I think that stems a lot from the mobile home, HUD home world, which is different than the modular kind of factory built world. But I think there's, like, a little bit of a remnant of a stigma for kind of factory built housing from that. And I think, you know, what I think would surprise a lot of people is just the kind of rigorous QC programs that are in place in all these factories that are building homes, right? It's actually really inspiring to see kind of these QC programs and manuals and checklists set up. And, you know, I know in our factory, there was countless people that needed to approve and go through a checklist before a module could move down the line, right? It couldn't even move unless all these sign-offs happened. And when you go out into the field, you see, for the most part, there's definitely no QC inspector. And the only QC that's really going to happen is if the building inspector happens to catch something, right? And write up a violation or a code violation. So I think, you know, there's a stigma of quality, but then I think there's this unknown quantity of not really recognizing the amount of QC that happens in factory built housing. And I think the other kind of thing that, you know, happens, negative aspect to factory built housing modular, is, you know, this thought that it needs to cost less than site built construction for it to make sense. And I think we saw that a lot, you know, at Connect Homes, where we would be weighed against site built construction. And I think there's a lot of other benefits to offsite construction that you guys have probably already dove into many times, but, you know, in terms of schedule, in terms of fixing price which is a big thing because typically on a, you know, home building site, you know, change orders are going to add 20 to 30%. And so if you've got that fixed price, you've got that certainty about what your home's going to cost.
You think that you, they actually have, they have to make changes on site?
Well, and to your point, Jared, I think doing offsite forces people to be more conscious of the decisions they're making up front, and there are less changes because it's going through a factory, right? Like there are going to be less, there's limitations to what the factory can and can't do, and timing of those changes, change decisions. Where on site, they can change it as soon as they put, as soon as they put that stud in, they can change it. They can do it 2 weeks later if they want to.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's crazy. And a lot of people who, you know, have built homes before and kind of come to us or come to Connect Homes and come to other factories, you know, they're just amazed that they don't have to make 1,000 decisions, right? They just love being handed, here's our standard fit out, here are upgrade packages, and then just a checklist, right? It's just like buying a car. It's like, I want this, I don't want that, I want this. Because, you know, when you build a house, you're just looking, you're going to like the tile place, you're looking at like hundreds of different tiles, you go into the appliance store. I mean, it's just draining all the decisions you have to make. And, you know, for most prefab companies, it's a real kind of here are standard features, here are upgrade packages. And it just takes all the stress out of it.
And it's very jaded in supply channel. Like I own a window and door company, and which product gets used is not necessarily because it's the best product for that project. It's about how the systems are set up, and the systems are about who gets paid for what.
So what getting your crystal ball out, Jared, what do you think the future of prefab and offsite construction? What do you see as the next trends or big thing in the offsite world?
Yeah. I think, when I look at where we are now, we're sort of, as an industry or as a space, kind of uncomfortably stuck in the middle between a construction process and an industrialized process. And I think if we want, as an industry, to have an output that's more like an industrialized product and less a construction project, then we need to tackle things beyond just kind of robots and automation. We need to like tackle essentially like the whole space on all fronts. And so that means like regulatory environment, that means financing, you know, everything. And so I like to think of, you know, a lot of people say, oh, like we're going to make building homes a lot like building cars. And, you know, you hear that a lot. And, you know, when I go, I recently did actually buy a car, and, you know, you can do the whole thing in a day, right? Like it's just crazy. You can choose kind of which car you want to get. You go to the dealer, you test drive it, you can get financing done, you get everything done, you go through your upgrades, which packages you want. It can be a really long day, but you drive off the lot that day in a new car. If you translate that to kind of getting a house right now, you know, you can do the start the same way. You can kind of choose different manufacturers, maybe kick the tires, go through a few model homes, choose which model you want, choose which upgrades you want. And then that's where the comparison stops, because at that point, you're not walking out with a home. You essentially started this timeline of potentially like 6 months to get local approvals, which is crazy because, again, factory built housing is already state approved. Yet regulatory wise, you still have to go through this local approval process that will add 3 to 6 months. Once you have your kind of local approvals or permit in place, that then triggers your ability to get your appraisal for your construction loan, right? And that adds 3 months. So you can start the process and think, I'm going to get a house right away. And there's 9 months before someone can even start building a house. And so, you know, I think we need to tackle those things, and we need to get to a point where someone can choose their manufacturer, maybe walk through a model, kick the tires, say, I want one of these homes, and have it delivered a week later, not like 9 months later. I think that's when it becomes more of an industrialized product and less of a construction project.
Yeah, and you bring a good point up. I mean, I own my own factory, and we certainly saw a lot of ups and downs, and a lot of it with in terms of even flow production, right? Like as a manufacturer, you're trying to keep things consistent, projects flowing, materials in, materials out. But, you know, there's certain things that are out of the certainly out of the manufacturer's control, might even be out of the general contractor's, ability to handle it. Some of this regulatory and compliance and appraisals and all that, and it throws a whole monkey wrench in the production schedule. So, you know, how did you manage those ups and downs in construction when, you know, fundamentally we're trying to make this smooth in manufacturing, but you're dealing with these outside factors, you're dealing with weather, and you're dealing with appraisals that didn't come in, or down payments that didn't get approved, or whatever it is, and it throws a whole wrench in your plans. What did you guys do?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I think like achieving steady state production is super challenging. And, you know, we definitely experienced that all along the way as we were scaling. And I think the challenge is you have a really steady production schedule that you can map out and look ahead and lay out all your open production slots based on the pace you have. And you're in complete control over that, right? So you have a steady production schedule that you can control. And then you got to map that against a sales backlog and a sales pipeline that is essentially completely out of your control and completely lumpy. And I think kind of transposing those and meshing those is a real, real challenge. And yeah, as you say, you know, if you're banking on kind of one big project, which I think a lot of the multifamily factories, you know, are relying on larger scale projects with maybe 100, 200 units. If that project slips and either the developer decides he needs to put a hold on it or it takes a little bit longer through entitlements, you know, now you have a big hole in your production schedule and you have to scramble to try and fill that. And so I think, you know, meshing those two is really challenging. And I think one of the lessons that we learned is that, and it's pretty critical, is if I have a production schedule or target in my, you know, business strategy and production strategy for, say, I'm going to make up a number, but I want to do a home every day in 12 months' time. Just given the long sales cycle, the long project cycle, to do that, that means I actually need to be selling a home every day now, not 12 months later, not 6 months later. But I need to be looking ahead to that production schedule and hitting sales targets potentially 12 months in advance. And so, you know, I think having like your production strategy, your business strategy, and your product strategy all aligned is really tough.
Yeah, we talked a lot about that in our pre-interviews of just trying to figure out how can we level this thing off. And that's really where we're on this quest of like, how do you vertically integrate in a better way? And you read a lot about this to where the factories get going and then they're like, or they start because of a large project and see that as the recipe for success. Jared, I'm curious your advice to that. And then Jason, if you can circle that back of like, how did you help when you had the big projects and then you didn't have the big projects? How do we level this stuff out, guys?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few different ways tools that we used. You know, one is if you have an open production slot, you can't rely on just having one project targeted for it. So for every kind of production slot that you're going to have open, you know, you need to have a couple projects that are going to be able to fill that slot. So if one moves slower, it can move out of it. If one moves faster, maybe it's ready to go and you can pull the trigger on it. So, you know, your sales essentially has to be larger than your production pace, your sales pace. That was one thing. The other thing that we tended to do, and I think was important, is, you know, you need to treat that front end process as an extension of your assembly line process. So all the dates that you're triggering for production slots need to pull them forward and then figure out what are the dates that you need local approvals for projects. What are the dates that you need to start procurement, to have a PO signed? And you work backwards from your production slots and you essentially have a production line and assembly line moving towards production. So you're making sure you're hitting all those dates to hit that open production start date. So I think that's one. And then, you know, I think what we also saw as a positive thing is once we kind of really built out a product platform where we had a diversified product line that appealed to developers, government agencies, and also homeowners, that allowed us to kind of cycle in different channels onto the production line and not just relying on one channel.
That's a big aha moment for me, Blanker, that, you know, it's kind of, we talk about these teams within the teams of like how the partners of the master facilitators all come together. And we have to figure out, instead of throwing grenades to the PM and to the checkbook, you have to have multiple projects kind of tied together, but they have to work into this one source of truth. I think there's so many silos within the silos that we have to break down that are critically important to say, projects are never on schedule. Well, they're not always delayed either. Sometimes there's ones that they're pushing ahead for it. And what we learned a lot through COVID and this supply chain debacle is we have to think differently to learn from that. Right, Blank?
Absolutely. And we worked, you know, closely with, you know, various different builders that would have, whether they're spec homes or other projects that we could pull up into production in case something pushed back. We got to the point we were doing some development ourselves, and just knowing that we had a foundation ready that we could pull that project into something that got pushed or pulled to try to keep the factory floor, you know, flowing as productively and as efficiently as possible, because that just frustrated our team for many years. It's just, you know, the ebbs and flows of projects not ready and delayed. And sometimes we had the opportunity that we could actually build that building and you know, stick it out and store it in the yard while they waited to get things together. But there's many projects that we couldn't because of whatever reason. It wasn't a guarantee that it was going to move forward. So you've got to get creative. You're absolutely right. And you've got to rely on those other partners, and you've got to get better at communicating with your customers and looking at other opportunities to either vertically or horizontally expand and integrate into your business.
Which is really hard to get out of your own way. But I raise my hand and say, like, when I started this journey, it's like, well, if a factory is just going to do his own work and external, like, they're going to be jaded. But you kind of have to be partners to be able to outsource inside or vice versa because of the ups and downs of how this works. But the key thing is, Jared, you talked about how we have to actually change about how we think construction overall. And it can't be a verse industrialized product. We kind of have to get there because that's the only way to affordability. That's the key thing that we're trying to figure out here, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, like the dream is you build one unit type, right? And you can build thousands of them. And if, you know, it's the same thing as like anything, like when Greg was, you know, doing RX CEO was doing the supply chain for iPods and, you know, iPhones. It was, they need to project out how many they think they're going to need that year based on kind of sales metrics and demand. And then they need to like produce that many, and they may end up overproducing. They may be short, you know, but trying to like nail that exact number is the challenge. And so if we just had one kind of unit type, we could just project out, we think we're going to sell 1,000 of these next year. We have these developers lined up. And we could just start building them, and that would allow us to have like the steady state of production. But then the kind of reality of what we do versus other industrialized products is, you know, every developer has a different site. Every developer is confronted with different setbacks and zoning and planning. And maybe they need to like make the units a little bit longer to maximize their number of units. Maybe they need to make them slightly smaller. So everything's different, which means it's more project-based, which means you can't just build 1,000 of them because you're not going to be able to sell 1,000 of kind of unit A. And so that's like the biggest challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I've been a big proponent of automation, and now we're seeing robotics get into the factory floor. But you made a good point earlier in the fact that we need to you need to have well-defined processes before you automate. I mean, fundamentally, there is a labor shortage. And whether that's on a job site or in a factory floor, we've got to look ahead. So what do you see for technology and construction, Jared? Where do you see the space going? There's a lot of people out there trying to come up with new systems and off the shelf systems and custom systems. Do you see anything working, or where do you see technology playing a role in construction?
Yeah, that's a good one. There's definitely companies out there, somewhat in stealth mode, some not, that are really focusing on, you know, a robotic solution that takes limited square footage, right? So rather than having all these automated equipment that takes like 50,000 square feet, it can really be in a confined space with lower CapEx requirements, and that can do a lot and kind of reduce the labor required. So I think that's an interesting aspect where it doesn't require kind of mega factories. It can be these more kind of agile, smaller factories that have, you know, really agile robots that can do most of the labor for a house in a small space. You know, from my perspective, what I found interesting with technology was more on the kind of the design side, on the kind of BIM modeling side, and how that can overlay onto the factory floor. And we were really starting to get into, which was important for us to scale, essentially taking all the rules that are embedded in what we do, all the tribal knowledge that's in everyone's head at you know, our company, and putting it actually into the BIM model itself. So the BIM model was smart enough to know you can do that, you can't do that. So I think, you know, once you kind of can layer in AI into this in a way that's compelling, where, you know, you can be essentially working on something and it can automatically tell you if it's not code compliant, if there's a conflict, if it's against your rules for how you do things. I think on the design side, there's a really compelling case for kind of getting technology more built in. And then once you have that, then it can output, you know, really good work instructions for the people on the line, where there's not this disconnect between someone does a design, someone does work instructions, someone looks at the work instructions. You can kind of roll it all into one.
That is so fascinating, because it's ironic. I have the pleasure of doing pre-interviews, recordings, and then Chloe and our amazing team does a great job of putting all these global and timeless fireside chats out every other week. Today, I have two pre-interviews and one recording. It's the third time I've heard, if AI can get what we need, if we can get these sources of truth dialed in, it can actually tell you if it meets code or not. That is a key thing I've heard from NREL this morning, from Naveen, talking about how fascinating where he's on this quest for 20 years where they just finished how to build stuff on Mars with no people. And now they're saying, let's reverse engineer how we could do that on Earth with a lot of people. Yes, we're struggling with labor and stuff. And that was a pre-interview I heard this morning that blew my mind. And then I had another meeting this morning on another deal, and he's just like, we got to do a podcast about AI. And I said, why? He's like, so that we know if the project's going to work or not. And so the race to the feasibility is like this key thing, that there's so much tech around that I just had to pause and say, it's fascinating, the stories, and it's such an honor, Jared, to have you here, of your so many lessons learned, but really looking to say, I think we're so passionate about, my one thing is like, how do we break through the ceiling and say this industrialized product, it is affordable and you do have the options like cars, but the way construction works, it's hard to give an analogy to building a car. So we have to rethink a lot of things. Jared, as our closeout, what is that one thing you want to leave our builders and affiliates to think about as they go out there to crush it and grow their business through system-built construction?
I think like maybe one would be, you know, really honing down and understanding your product market fit, kind of really understand what problem you're solving that's in the market, and one, what unmet need the customer has that you're solving. I think that will really go a long way to really understanding what your mission is and staying course.
Blanker, what an honor to have Jared here as a master facilitator. There's plenty of problems to solve. This is a great platform to help each other to solve them, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's where these master facilitator groups getting in there, we can continue the conversation there and try to really dive into solving and actually putting in practical application of some of these things that we're talking about. So,
and we'll make sure to put the links on the show notes of all the stuff Jared's been putting on LinkedIn, and we're honored to have him in the Master of Facilitators. If someone wants to talk to us behind LinkedIn, That's what we're doing here to vertically integrate these projects. Jared, it's such an honor to have you on the Art of Construction and coming in and sharing your story.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Really nice to meet you, Devin and Jason, and really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Crush it out there.